Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 23rd, 1999, and in the Creekside Room this afternoon, Marsha Bungie continues her child advocacy session, and this one is called Child Advocacy and the Church, New Testament Foundations. This is tape 99-8, and now let's go to the Creekside Room for Marsha's presentation.
I'm Marsha Bungie. I'm a professor at Valparaiso University at Christ College. It's the Honors College of the University. And I'm also the director of a project called The Child in Christian Thought. I'm working together with about 16 scholars. We're looking back in the Christian tradition and seeing what have theologians said about the nature of children and about our obligations to children, not just parents, but also the church and the community. So it's been a very interesting project for me, and I've been doing a theme here at Holden on children, the family, and faith that looks at some of the specific themes that have come up in our discussions about the past and also our concerns about the present. So I've done a few sessions on sin, depravity, and children, which is a theme you find in the tradition. Also the vocation of parenting. Last couple days we looked at the spiritual life of children, and today and tomorrow I want to talk about child advocacy and the church. So I had been speaking quite a bit the last couple times, but today what I'd like to do is to focus on a few questions together in a bit more of a discussion type of atmosphere. And I thought what we'd like to do, because I know we're all concerned about the situation of children, of course, the tragedy at Littleton has raised our awareness about some of these issues. We've all been asking questions about, where were the parents? What about the nature of our schools now? What about the nature of violence on TV? How much effect does that have on children? So we've all been asking these questions and wondering what we can do to help children in our midst. So today what I'd like to do is four things. First, take some time to just briefly review the situation of children today, to talk about some of the concerns that we share, to kind of highlight some of those concerns and talk about the need for advocacy. And now advocate literally means it's one summoned to speak for someone else, or one summoned to be called for another, and usually in a court of law. So when we're talking about child advocacy, we're talking about people who can speak on the behalf of children and try to do something to address their needs. So we'll talk about that, and then I'd like to explore what are some of the obstacles we see in our own lives, in the church, and in the community for child advocacy, for people speaking out for children and doing something to address their needs. Then I'd like to look at the New Testament and see if there are some biblical foundations for child advocacy. If we could look at a few texts from the New Testament to see how we might think a little bit differently about children as we look at these texts. I think doing something like this, looking at the biblical foundations and at the theological foundations for child advocacy, will help us see more clearly how child advocacy is a part of our understanding of the Christian faith, or should be, our understanding of the Christian life. And then I'd like to talk about some of our own suggestions and kind of brainstorm together about things we have done, sort of individually and maybe in our church, being advocates for children, and share some ideas. So I have a little handout here, and we'll look at a few New Testament texts in a minute. But these are a few statistics I highlighted from. Oops, this one didn't have two sides. Everyone should have two sides. From the Children's Defense Fund. You can also get a lot of these statistics from the National Commission on Children and the State of the World's Children, another resource. So let's just look at the front page where it talks about the situation of children today and the need for child advocacy. Did everybody get a sheet so far?
It's happening.
Okay. I just highlighted a few things concerning some of the major issues, and I've put those in capital letters. Let's just look at poverty for a minute. In our country, 1 in 5 children lives in poverty. So whereas in 1970, you had about 10 million children living in poverty, by 1994, that was about 14.5 million children living in poverty. And we're talking here about poverty defined as about $12,000 for a 3-person family, $12,000 a year. So 1 in 5.
What is that, the country or the county?
That's in the country, in the United States, in our country. 69% of these poor children lived in families where someone in the home was working. So we're talking about the situation of the working poor. So poverty, of course, puts children at risk in a number of areas. Poor children face greater risk of stunted growth or anemia. They have repeated years of schooling. They often have lower test scores and less education, as well as lower wages when they finally get a job in adulthood. So all segments of society pay the cost of child poverty because the burden gets passed around in terms of the hospital costs or extra schooling or extra tutoring for children and social services and, of course, the criminal justice system. All of society would share the gains if poverty, if we could address poverty in a more urgent kind of direct way. As one economic advisor stated, it seems both immoral and unintelligent for a nation as rich as America not to lift children out of poverty. Now, in terms of health care, we all know this is also a very difficult situation. In 1998, more than 11 million children were without health insurance, and 90% of them had working parents. So 90% of the uninsured had somebody in the home working. Now, this new state children's health insurance program, which was passed last year, should help to bring about 5 million children insurance if the states conform to what they're supposed to be doing. So that's a good sign of hope. However, the lack of health insurance for children is puzzling. As Marion Wright Edelman has said, she's the head of the Children's Defense Fund, why should every 66-year-old in the United States be guaranteed health coverage and not every 6-year-old or 16-year-old? Is one life more valuable than the other? Why should a child in one state have a chance to live and grow up healthy and not a child in another? Because the laws, as you know, between states vary so much. We just moved from Minnesota to Indiana. Of course, Minnesota, we had a lot of taxes, but we had a lot of social services, a lot of emphasis on education. And in Indiana, the situation is very uneven. Education. Well, because many states depend on local dollars to meet a portion of the cost of public education, there are many inequities, as we know. I'm sure some of you have known the work of this Jonathan Kozel, K-O-Z-O-L, who's written about savage inequalities and talked a lot about poverty in schools and the costs of not putting enough education resources, not just necessarily financial resources, but resources into poor areas and poor schools. Students from families with low incomes are approximately 8 times more likely to drop out of school, and so in the United States, 1 out of 8 teenagers doesn't complete high school. That's a really significant amount of children. Child care. I love this statistic. These are all, again, mainly from the Children's Defense Fund, but most states require about 1,500 hours of training to become a manicurist or a hairstylist. But more than 30 states do not require a single hour of training for child care workers. Broken down, 39 states do not require prior training for providers who look after children in their homes. And 32 states do not require prior training for teachers in child care centers. Not a single hour. So what does that say about how we value children in our culture? When we look at what we require from these workers and also what we pay them. Challenges to family life, there are so many challenges to facing family now. We can look at teenage pregnancy rates, that's a very good thing. Those rates have been coming down. But nevertheless, we still have about 1 in 8 children being born to a teenage mother. Also, 1 in 2 children will live in a single-parent family at some point in childhood. And there's been a lot of very good work done now from both the conservative side and the liberal side on the effects of divorce. If you know some of the work of Popenoe, there's Jean Baker Elstein, another person, Barbara Whitehead, who've talked about the effects emotionally and even intellectually in all kinds of ways on children of divorce. And of course, we all recognize divorce is good in some cases, especially in cases of a high conflict and abuse. That is good for the children. It's a much better situation. But according to the studies by Popenoe and another, Paul Amato, two-thirds of those divorces are not high-conflict marriages. And even if they're not the best, happiest marriages, children seem to thrive more in that situation than in a situation of divorce. People are also struggling to balance work and family. We have a lot of conversations up here at Holden with lots of families about how they're trying to do that. A lot of people work longer hours. Many people do not eat dinner regularly with their families anymore. There's some statistic that it's almost like 69% of children watch television while they're eating dinner. So this is what they're doing during dinner instead of having a conversation with their parents. Grandparents and children. In 1996, 2.14 million children lived in a household headed by a relative who had no parent present. And a majority of these children, 1.5 million children, lived with their grandparents. And I'm sure maybe in your area you've seen support groups popping up for these grandparents who are taking care of their children, who are the sole guardians of these children. And they need a lot of support, psychologically and financially, too, to take on that role of parenting these children. Violence and crime. Well, there's some good news, because according to the data from 97, there are fewer young people dying from gunfire, fewer people being murdered, and fewer being arrested for violent crimes. However, this is also such a startling statistic. Children under age 15 are still 12 times more likely to die from gunfire than children in 25 other industrialized nations combined. And if you ever look at those lists of murder rates, you know, it's just like, you look at Japan, Norway, Germany, they're just minimal compared to the murder rates. And then if you talk about children who are being killed by guns in our country, this rate is way out of line in relation to other industrialized countries. About 5,285 children, that's about 14 children a day, were killed by guns in their homes, neighborhoods, or schools in 1998. And as Edelman has written, this again, the Children's Defense Fund, when the polio virus killed 2,700 adults and children at its peak year, that was 7 a day, we declared a national emergency for this polio, just this tragedy. And yet, why don't we declare a national emergency to stop this deadly gun virus that's killing almost twice as many children a day?
That's a Columbine High School every
day. Yeah, and you think of how we all just suffered with those families and suffered with those kids and the effect on the friends of those children and their neighbors and the parents, and we were all kind of suffering with that whole community. And think about that. That's right. It's one of those a day. There's concern, too, about inadequate moral and spiritual formation. A growing number of children seem to lack a strong sense of right and wrong, or they lack a sense of purpose or meaning in their life. Rates of juvenile suicide and depression continue to rise in our country. I put this statistic in again because I'm always so alarmed by that children watch about 27 hours of TV a week and are drowning in advertising that is telling them how to look and feel and act. And Wes, in his session the first day, this statistic was very startling to me, where he's saying we're bombarded with about 3,000 advertisements a day. If you talk about the magazines, the billboards, the commercials, that's a tremendous amount of our time. Even if we don't talk about what effect does this have on children, how does it influence them to become more violent or aggressive, even if we don't, just take that away and just say, look at the amount of time that's being spent. And you think, oh, an hour of television a day, you add that up in 8 days, that's 8 hours. That's 8 hours of your time where maybe you could have been speaking to one another. It's also shown in just a very recent study, 75% of young people would like more time to speak with their parents. And I mentioned this earlier, but during that Littleton tragedy, a lot of young people said they want more time to speak with their parents, and that the Merton Strumman, we talked a little bit about him on Monday, the head of the Search Institute, he's the one who said, boy, you got to get that communication in very early, because by the time you get to fifth grade, it's really after that, it's too late to try to, you know, get a very good intimate kind of discussion going with your children. You really have to cultivate that till fifth grade and be very intentional about having some kind of caring conversation where you know that your children, where you're listening to your children and they know that you're listening to them. Well, in my setting, I'm a college professor. I see this, you know, even though I work with very privileged students, a lot of them, we were saying the other day, you know, don't know much about the tradition, can't really articulate much about their faith. It doesn't really seem to relate to their everyday life. They'd say, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, but you don't really know how it relates much to the everyday life. Or a lot of my friends, you read in a lot of literature on colleges today, they talk about the tremendous amount of moral relativism you see among students where, you know, professors used to show something shocking like, you know, a kind of cannibalism or something like that in a story, and they think that, you know, students would be kind of shocked by this. But well, they could see where that might happen, or they could see where, you know, infant sacrifice might happen. So there's kind of a concern about that from many people today. Now, even if we would disagree about whether it's worse than it was before, because a lot of people say, oh, we've always had problems with kids, and this isn't worse than before. And when I look back at some of the history of Christian thought, everybody was worried about adolescence. You know, everybody is like 14. Wow, what do we do with 14, age 14? It's, you know, way back in the 4th century, in the 16th century. So maybe we might say, oh, we've always had these kind of problems. But nevertheless, look at the problems we have, even if it's not as bad as it was before. These are enough problems to say we have a lot of concerns here for children and we need to address them. So there's a tremendous need for child advocacy. And again, it's simply speaking out for children and helping to address their needs. And it can take shape in many forms. Typically, you talk about advocacy in terms of creating awareness about issues, teaching people about what's going on, about creating programs to benefit children that could be in your church or in your community, changing legislation, writing to your, you know, senators, trying to do something to change the laws, and then working with community and public agencies. So you could see in the church a kind of program for advocacy could be a real strong mentoring program in your church to really address the moral formation of children, or just a great Sunday school program. That would be, in a way, another kind of advocacy that you could have for children, because you're trying to meet their needs, you're speaking out for them, and making them feel welcome in the worship service is really another form of advocacy. Well, now, even though the church has kind of does have a record of advocacy for speaking out for children and doing things for children, there are signs that we don't do enough in the church, and we could talk about that together a little bit, some of the ways we see maybe we're not doing enough for children in our congregations. And then I'd like to speak just together a little bit about what does get in the way of speaking out for children and doing more to address their needs. I'm thinking in my own congregation just about the Sunday school program. We always have trouble getting somebody. Nobody wants to teach Sunday school. The materials that we pick, I know there's very good materials out there, but the materials that were picked for the particular year are not very good materials. People are scrambling to create another Sunday school curriculum. A lot of children don't feel welcome in the worship service. So you talk about the youth pastor. A lot of people think about being the youth pastor as sort of stepping stone to something else. Or, you know, we don't really hold that up as a central position in the church, working with the youth. So I don't know, I'd like to just talk for just a few minutes and then maybe look at the New Testament together and see if there's some things that open our eyes. But what are some of the obstacles you see to child advocacy, you know, in our culture or in your own life or in the church?
I think one of them is that oftentimes, was somebody raising their hand and I got in?
That's okay.
Okay. One of them is that people are afraid that they will hurt another person's feelings if they make statements about stay-at-home moms and the role and relationship that is with children. How does that feel if you're that single parent? Or how does that feel if you're that working parent? You don't want to hurt other people's feelings by the church making statements about what is good for children, because we all know sometimes we're doing things that isn't the best. Maybe we do let them watch more TV than we should or whatever. But nobody's telling us. You know, you're afraid to speak out about that stuff.
You don't want to interfere.
That whole thing.
Absolutely.
I mean, I hear all the time young old people in our church saying, you know, well, all those kids, if they would just, you know, what they don't want to tell the kids how to do it. They just say, well, they'll learn.
What do you think that's related to? Just explore that a little more.
I think it has to do with a sense of individualism in our country, and that you know, we're not really in relationship with each other, so we don't really know the bounds of how we can enter into those conversations with each other. We haven't really laid the groundwork to be able to say, you know, perhaps challenging things to one another and not have it sound like a criticism. Because and that, I think, comes back to the whole sense of, you know, we all live in our little houses with our little cars and we all do our own little thing, and we come together for church or for meetings or for whatever, but we're not really connected.
I was gonna respond to what you had said as far as obstacles. And one obstacle I see in our Sunday school for the young people is that they feel that it was meant for people like 50 or 100 years ago, and today to make it relevant to their lives, their problems, is a challenge. I think it's a huge challenge, and I would love to know how to meet that challenge, because they don't feel like it's relevant. It's archaic, you know. So
the Sunday school materials,
materials, the songs. You know, 1685, you know, the songs that we love and treasure, they listen to them and go, you know?
Yeah.
So I think the whole thing needs a huge revamping of some sort.
To speak to young people.
Yeah.
Are there other thoughts you have about obstacles, either related to that or really as roots of why we don't talk to one another more about children?
Really busy schedules. Carving out the time.
Marcia, you mentioned this too, but increasingly I think children are seen society-wise as consumers. And I've read a really astonishing statistic, the difference between the amount of access to money that children had 30 to 40 years ago versus today, and the amount of consumption that's generated by children. Mm-hmm. So much of the advertising you talked about is oriented towards children now. I think it makes it very hard to buck that trend if you're an adult in a child's life.
Yeah.
Or if you're an adult going to church, you want to have it done to you instead of being a part of the service or a part of the planning or a part of the being a teacher. We're finding it really difficult to get volunteers. Oftentimes people are coming to church and that's what they do. I come to church, now fill me up and then I leave and I'll come back next week. I guess the question for me or the obstacle is their participation in leading and working with their children, but also in becoming a community.
Did I see that?
I was going to say, the paradox is children are seen as consumers, but also simultaneously as commodities. And that is fed by our deep individualism. Later this summer, we're going to be producing here with volunteer staff a play called The Baby Dance. Very interesting play about a young middle class, or I don't know, young middle class couple, white couple, who is paying for the medical care of a poor woman living in a trailer with her husband and four kids who's pregnant, and they're going to adopt this baby. And it's a very interesting play. This whole thing about the commodification of children, that we have children for our own needs. We aren't complete unless we do have children, but it's somehow a right And even something, as this play is going to bring out, they can be bought and sold. And at the end of the play, the delivery is bad, the vocal cord is too short, it's wrapped around the child's neck, not enough oxygen to the brain, and the couple's sort of voting and signing papers. So this is a damaged commodity here that can't really be sent back. It's very interesting, but I think that pulled the childless consumer and childless commodity. And that leads also, I think, part of this individualism that I've faced in the parish is from older people. Well, I did that. I raised my kids. I taught Sunday school. And now I'm done. And I found that in my last meeting, even trying to get retired people or people whose children were gone to vote for taxes for schools. Their kids had made it through the public schools, they were not supporting them. So that sense that not that the children of our community or our church or our nation, in a sense, belong to us all.
Right.
But my kids got through and now I don't care what happens.
Yeah. Right.
Let the younger people do it.
Right.
And I sense some of that in myself too. I think, well, I've got teens in my house. I don't want to teach the 40-year-olds anymore. I'm guilty of some of that myself.
I think it's related, like what you were saying about individualism. You've got your little family, and we talk a lot about the rights of the biological parents, you know, the rights of the absolute rights, so you don't want to step in on those rights or the property of, you know, that couple. It is kind of a sense of children as property, as products.
Which is completely different than how people and families and communities would have come together when they didn't live in industrial cities as we do now. I mean, there's a story that comes from the neighborhood that I live in. It's an area in Seattle where kids regularly would walk back and forth to the little local school. And when we moved to this area, people that we met in the neighborhood who had been there for a long time said, oh, you know, back in the old days, we used to know all the kids who were walking to school, and if we saw them doing such and such a thing, we would call their parent and tell them. Well, now nobody knows anybody, and so you've got these kids that are kind of moving around, and there is no accountability because there is no, if your parent doesn't see it, then like it didn't happen.
That's true.
And you know, and there is no sense that you can speak to a child who is not of your family.
I grew up in an area like that. Everyone knew me, and I didn't dare do anything wrong because then it would get bad.
You knew the eyes were wider than your household.
Absolutely. One of the flip sides to the, you know, people not volunteering stuff is I think we are increasingly, there's been so much attention to the different kinds of abuse issues related to children that people are very afraid sometimes to get involved in liability issues. Or, for example, in my case as a gay man, oftentimes gay and lesbian people, there's so much concern if we are involved in children anyway. We had this come up in our congregation, which is a very liberal congregation, but the first time an openly lesbian person was teaching in the church school, that it raised all sorts of issues. Should we allow, you know, this again? But I think that whole sense about
safety
is a real legitimate issue, but it's also one that now prevents a lot of people from, I don't want to get involved, there's liability issues, and you see it with school teachers, you see it with all sorts of issues.
I think that's very important.
We ran a whole curriculum for a three-week period on child abuse with the Sunday school program this year, all the way from kindergartners up to high school youth, and it was very, very well done. And everybody that was a Sunday school instructor was trained, and it was beautifully done, and it worked very, very well. There were people that were uncomfortable, and by the time it came time to do the program, it worked out really well. So
maybe sometimes addressing it, you're saying,
addressing it
makes everybody feel more comfortable.
And
we got through that.
Yeah, and having some backup for, you know, people. There was some statistic that had come forward that you're going to hear about this as things that are actually happening, even if you don't think you want to hear it.
Yeah.
And who do you have as trained individuals for people to call? And it was all orchestrated, so it was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the name of the publisher?
Not off the top of my head, but if you can hear them, I'll get you the name.
Okay. Yeah.
I think there's some real resistance to learning parenting skills too. a lot of things have changed for children. And the reality is that we parent the way our parents parented us, unless we decide to consciously do it differently or learn what it is we want to throw out and keep of the way that happened. But and at the same time, you can offer parenting courses, and we have that because parents are busy, they're overwhelmed, and it's like, it ain't broke right now, so I don't want to even mess with it.
Yeah.
And particularly with step parenting classes, you know.
It's always on the verge of being broken.
And that's too bad.
How do you reconcile that, which I think is true, with this huge willingness to devote lots of time to preparing for birth? To all his mom's classes and learning to give birth. What's the break there that a couple's willing to go through lots of training to get through birth, but they aren't as willing to go through training to be a new parent for the next?
I think it just hasn't been emphasized. I think that, you know, there's a huge amount of advocacy for the importance and value of understanding the birth process, and it kind of cuts. You know, the moment you're kind of discharged from the hospital, thank you, here's your bundle, and good luck. And, you know, and it, great if you have someone around who can help you, but if you don't, you're kind of like, you know, looking at the yellow pages.
Well, it's kind of in a way that we, with couples wanting, if they spend as much time preparing for their marriage as they do the wedding.
Yes,
And now pastors are saying, we're not marrying you unless you have so many sessions, but you can get into some of that family board and stuff that gets carried on
And there's been like coalitions of a lot of churches and religious groups coming together saying, well, we are going to make a kind of covenant together to say we're going to really do this and have a lot of preparation for marriage. So I know a lot of nurses too, they just feel so bad, they just send out the kids. Well, in other systems, like in England, boy, you have a midwife coming all the time, and this nurse all the time for the next 3 weeks or so, checking in on you, talking to you, coming in the home, helping you out in any way. It's set up very differently than here. I think that's right. You got here's your package. You know what to do. Go away. And again, maybe it's related to this, again, sort of private. It's my, these are my children. Now you have no right to tell me what to do, because I know what to do with my children. Maybe we should look for a little bit right now at some of the passages in the New Testament and hold up some of these, you know, attitudes we have to children, attitudes, kind of obstacles to speaking out for children and doing more to address their needs. And just look at some of these wild passages in the New Testament. I think they're so striking when you look at them. So let's just take a look at them for just a few minutes.
I should give you this. Marcia,
I think it's
quite a challenge to be a grandparent today in today's world, too.
Yes.
You know, you draw on how my parents raised me and how I raised my children, but then my grandchildren are being raised in quite a different way. Not bad, just different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm called upon to be helpful, but I know that my opinions are not always requested, so I really try to not do that part. But, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
You don't always think it's safe.
Because you have a lot of contact with these children.
A lot of love for these children.
And I think it's funny. Why aren't we more willing to share information a little bit more and take advice about child rearing?
It's really sensitive.
It is very sensitive. Even that subject about stay-at-home mothers and working mothers, that is so sensitive. They have this wonderful program in Minnesota called Early Childhood Education, and they bring in parents and the kids. And it's just amazing. I think, wow, we should do this in the church with Sunday school, where you bring in your kids. The parents and the kids together are there learning something, and then the parents go off a little while, and the children play alone, and then they come back, and you know what happened with the kid. You can discuss it, but parents have a time to talk together, get to know one another. You have a real sense of support for those children. So I think that's been a very, very good program. I think, why couldn't we do something a little more there but one issue they couldn't talk about there, they could talk about everything, ear infections, you know, spanking, the whole gamut.
But they refused to talk about daycare issues or working parents and stay-at-home mothers. They said, we've just had so many bad experiences with that. We don't want to touch that subject. When people are wondering, you know, is day of care okay? How many hours it would be okay? You know, and what should I be doing here? They're struggling with these issues. But they said that's the absolute thing we will not talk about. Hmm. So let's look just for a minute at some of these texts, and we won't focus on them all. I thought we'd just look at some of the ones in the gospel. I brought them along because I thought it's kind of interesting to see some of the texts about children in the New Testament. Basically, there's not an extended treatment of children in the New Testament, but there are references to children in general and to children used in a metaphorical sense. And this in itself is kind of remarkable because children at that time weren't really considered much of anything at all. At that time, the household was organized very hierarchically with the father at the top, then the mother, children, and slaves. And so the children had a very low status. So it's very remarkable in a way that children are included, even in the epistles where they talk about mainly you've got to teach your children about the faith and that children should obey their parents. That's mainly what you get in the epistles. And there's a guy at Notre Dame, Whitcomb is his name, who's done a lot on viewing the views of children in the past. And he said, even today in the Catholic Church, we talk so much about families, we kind of go back just to saying, you know, teach your kids the faith and obey. They should obey you. That's about it. That's about all we're going to say about raising our kids, when really there's a lot more to say. But when you get to the Gospels, boy, there's some really interesting things happening there about views of children and attitudes of children. I thought, just let's see if they inform us in any way in conversation with how we think about how we think we view children today. Let's just look for a minute at this first one, welcoming the child. Mark 9:33-37. Maybe somebody could read that one.
Then they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" But they were silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me."
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's just talk a little bit about your response to this text.
Well, it kind of turns the world upside down, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? If you're thinking, you know, okay, you could think back in that culture, and the view of children in that culture is almost nothing. You could abandon them legally, you know, and let them die if you didn't want them. Boy, and welcoming the child. And then the strong statement, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. What's all that about?
There's the service component, I mean, that we talked a little bit about. I guess that was only yesterday. That you need to act out the things. You don't just need to, you know, read it or learn it or know it. Mm-hmm. You have to do something.
Mm-hmm. So the actual act of welcoming, and then turning, like you say, the notion of community upside down, the notion of who is valued, totally upside down. One, the least in our society, that's who you've got to welcome if you're going to welcome me. The least. So it's very inclusive. You think about the role of women in the ancient world, we go, you know, we say, wow, it's so oppressive and so patriarchal. And this is even sort of a lower rank when you're talking about rung and the whole ladder there, children. And Jesus picking up the child and saying, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me.
I find that action to be almost as illuminating as his words.
Mm-hmm.
That he took the little child and put the child among them. Those who were trying to dismiss the child or ignore the child or discredit the relevance of the child. And
say,
right here, put this child in your midst and look at the child and know this child. And then he takes the child in his arms. He demonstrates what he's talking about. It's not just words from Jesus. It's
Mm-hmm. And taking up, somebody was talking about how in the ancient world, if you wanted to keep the child, the father took up the child after it was born to show this woman will keep. Mm-hmm. If the father did not take up the child, then you could abandon it. So that, I mean, when you put that together with what you're saying about not just, hey, see the kid over there? That kid's important, but bringing it right in the middle and taking up the child, that's a very good point. Well, let's just look at the next one and, you know, kind of put these together. How about the Mark 10 one, Mark 10, 13? Anybody want to read that?
People were bringing little children to him in order that he might touch them, and the disciples spoke sternly to them. But when Jesus saw this, he was indignant and said to them, "Let the little children come to me. Do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of God belongs. Truly I tell you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will never enter it." And he took them up in his arms, laid his hands on them, and blessed them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now there's been so many interpretations of this text, but let's just talk about what your response to this text is.
My response to this is that we make sure as adults we take time to value children, what they think, what they say, and anybody who's worked with kids know how mm-hmm. incredibly insightful they can be, and mm-hmm. beautiful thoughts and things come from what they say.
Mm-hmm. So valuing children, kind of respecting them, seeing their worth. What else do people see here?
Well, Jesus was not pleased when they did not pay attention.
Yeah.
Tried to treat them as less than.
Mm-hmm. Was indignant.
Mm-hmm.
Marsha, I have two responses. One is I can really imagine that just an overwrought, exhausted parent looking at Jesus and saying, "It's clear you've never had kids." Because they're almost time sometimes.
Checking
when
out.
Oh, like, yeah, real Jesus. But the other thing, too, is that, and I know I'm guilty of this, too, because I tend to focus right away on the children I know in my life, but I also think that this word of appreciation is also a word of judgment about the ways we do treat children. I think, societally, I just don't get so hung up on the fact that we seem perfectly willing as a society to let one out of every four children be born and raised in poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, what is this saying about our whole social makeup, that the wealthiest nation on earth seems quite comfortable with that.
Yeah, that one little fact, that's where Herb Anderson says, we are a culture of contempt for children.
Yeah.
We think we love children. We have like high chairs in the restaurants. We have Baby Gap. It's great. We got soccer, all kinds of cute things for your kids. But if you just look at the one fact about poverty, how we would let that many children when it has carried with it so many risks and so many things connected to their future. There is something about that real judgment of that kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on.
I would say that in both these texts, they're even more powerful than what we said. In the first one, Jesus is saying, I come to you in these little ones.
Yes.
I mean, this is how I come to you. And secondly, the child is not just lifted up as one to cherish, but that we are to become this way. This is how we know the reign of God, is by imitating children.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't, again, it isn't just that we appreciate them, but that we have to become like them, and that in them is where we're going to meet Jesus. I mean,
and that, like you say, the first point about this is the representative.
Yes.
This is the representative of Jesus. Whoever welcoming this one is welcoming me.
And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me.
Yes.
That's
very powerful. Mm-hmm.
And the other image that really lives for me is the sense about
Whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will never enter into it. And the image that I have is when a child is turning to its mother or its parent or whoever is going to nourish it, just that incredible sense of bonding and openness mm-hmm. that the child has, that you know, that you can't cut that bond at that moment. Mm-hmm. And how many of us, when we're turning to God, when we're praying, or when we're having you know a moment or whatever, really enter into it with that same intensity of bonding that a child does when it's going to the, you know, its nourishment or the one who's going to protect it, you know. And that's the thing, is like we've become so sophisticated and we're adults and we're savvy and you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like we've forgotten what it's like to be absolutely dependent on someone.
Right, that notion of what does it mean to be like a little child. So you're talking about bonding and kind of openness. Matthew, you'll notice just above it, Matthew 18, 1 to 5, kind of connects the above passage and the below passage by saying, whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom. And then as the welcoming, so there's a sense of humility. It's kind of interesting, Schleiermacher, what this 19th century theologian, he said, becoming like a little child is really being in the present. That's what communion with God is. That's what eternal life is really, is being in communion with God. That's what childlike means. There's a lot of rich kind of reflection on what that actually means, this being childlike. Let's just look at the last, about the first two. But this is also very interesting and very outrageous, really. Matthew 21, 14 to 16. Somebody over there want to read it? Mary, you
want to
go ahead?
Sure. The blind come to him in the temple, and he cured them. When the chief priests and the scribes saw the amazing things that he did and heard the children crying out in the temple, Hosanna to the Son of David, they became angry and said to him, do you hear what these are saying? Jesus said to them, yes. Have you never read? Out of the mouths of infants, nursing babies, you have prepared praise for yourself.
Maybe just the last one. At that time, Jesus said, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you've hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent and have revealed them to infants. So let's just put up, without forgetting, kind of these images and attitudes we've had, we talked about in our time. Let's just put up some of the things we said. These texts have opened up for us a broader sense of community. We talked about children as examples. We talked about children as being representatives of Jesus and kind of a, you know, one who welcomes me. You know, they're, woo, you're, and then, let's see, from this text, do you have a response to this text? This is really, I think, pretty dramatic as well. We talked about the judgment. Kind of our content.
This one to me says include children in all the parts of your, you know, worshipfulness, and don't leave them out.
Mm-hmm. So kind of including them in a sense, our praise to God.
Mm-hmm.
Participation. I think what this one is also very interesting is it's really saying children are also vehicles of revelation. That doesn't mean they're smarter than us or they've got more in tune with God necessarily, but they can be vehicles of revelation. And boy, that's really far from the way I think we treat children, isn't it? Kind of like, we're going to help you, we're going to teach you everything, you know, you stay over here. But to see them as vehicles of revelation, that's really, I think, also quite a revelation. anything else you want to add to just some of our responses to these texts?
Marcia?
Yeah?
Could I add another text?
Yeah.
Because my favorite gospel does not mention children.
Yeah.
And they, it's, or poor, or any of that. But the one child who appears in John's gospel is in the story of the multiplication of the loaves. This boy who has these gifts, a few bread and a few fish. Mm-hmm. And I'm always so, again this morning, looking at that text, so taken with what I call the pre-rational or irrational offering of gifts in the face of all this hunger. No grown-up would say, well, I brought a fish and some loaves. But the child offers what he has, and in the hands of Jesus, this feeds the multitude. So that's that sense of just, maybe it is being in the present, maybe it isn't, it's that you aren't thinking you are totally, a child doesn't think he or she is totally in charge of the consequences of everything, how it plays out. But at that moment, the child has some fish and bread and offers it. Mm-hmm. And so I see, and it's important to note that though the multiplication story is in every one of the synoptics and twice in one, only in John is it mentioned a little boy. So it is, that's not a synoptic mention of children. But there he is, the source of sustenance and of faith, I think. Because Philip is being tested by Jesus, of how are we going to feed them? And the narrator says, Jesus says this to test both, because Jesus already knew what he was going to do. And here is the model of faith, of offering the gift.
Thank you very much. Yes, that's such a, that was, we had this, this sort of funeral service, well, a commemoration of a pastor who died recently, very suddenly, 38 years old, a wonderful, wonderful person, and she helped go through that text, and that was so revealing, that text, as she talked about it. And I think there's many other texts that we could use in the New Testament, too. This is just a little segment, but just look at these little tiny texts we picked out, and what a challenge to the way we think about children. I mean, just these little tiny texts, and what a challenge, how they are really kind of, like you're saying earlier, kind of turn our view upside down. And that notion that children can be vehicles of revelation, if you start thinking that way, they really do open up so much and teach us so much, I think. They are, but so often in our services and in the programs, you know, it's just, we're going to do something for you. We don't really make them, you know, give them a part in the worship service or give them a part in the community like we could.
But the other thing that I notice is we plug them in.
We have
a little compartment that they're supposed to fit in. And if
instead,
they don't fit in that, then it gets messy.
Yeah.
Or if they're commodified again, it's turned into a performance.
On stage, off stage.
They're leading us in worship or joining, or we join them in worship. It's, they do something cute for our entertainment. I've heard so many children's sermons that commodify the children, where the children become a prop for the pastor to look more humane. I mean,
And the kids know it. You know, they sense that.
Right. You're not really offering us anything. We're telling you what you're going to do in the service here. You're going to play the role we need you to play, instead of really listening to them. When we had our child, it was really neat. It was some person gave me a little quote. It said, a child is not a project, but a revelation. And that was a very good thing to receive. It had this very beautiful sort of blessing for all people who had children. And that was a beautiful statement, because we do treat them a lot of times as products. Well, I've got to make, like you were talking about projects and products, about the one child was kind of damaged goods.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do about that? And all the lessons we have, all the things we, what are we forming them to? You know, we should ask ourselves, what are we doing all these things for? What kind of product? I mean, it's something like your product. You're going to produce a product at the end by doing all these certain lessons and things for kids. So anyway, isn't that challenging? Isn't that eye-opening? Just this little tiny time we took to do this.
If I can, there's one other thing. Those last three, that Mark, Matthew, Luke. There's striking common thread through those.
Oh, the healings. Or are you talking about?
Mark 10, 13, Matthew 9, 10,
okay,
13,
so let the little children come to me one.
In each of those three texts, there's a common theme of touch. And boy, what how our culture needs to
and like you were saying earlier, kind of putting them, bringing them into the center.
But that's, you know, that's a real problem area. We live in a culture where teachers are not allowed to touch. Pastors are going through boundary sessions to be taught how to touch. You know, that's really become a problem in our culture.
Due to a few people abusing it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And where can that healthy touch occur? And it clearly ought to occur, but how can we do that?
It touches in both of these healing stories, too. Yeah. Jesus takes them by the hand. So in every one of these, it is just woven.
You know, and we didn't have time to go through the household code ones, but even there were they saying children obey the parents. There is this sense, too, that fathers should not provoke their children to anger. And there is, you know, that's, people talk about how that's a very interesting text in itself, too, as well, in that period where, hey, you know, you do what I say, that you obey the father sort of absolutely. But here it's a kind of, you know, in Christ you have a love and respect for this. There's a kind of mutual love and submission in that relationship, even to children. So, gosh, we only have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to end on a kind of positive note and talking about what things have you done in your church that you think have been very good for children or in your community. And we might share some resources and some ideas. I have some resources over there, too, and I put a few on the back of the sheet. But I thought we should take a few minutes and talk about that.
I would say that opening the sacrament of the table to all the baptized is maybe the single most important ritual enactment of what Jesus is saying.
Uh-huh.
And what I hear, don't hinder the children from coming to me.